But boy, I tell you, all those people just adapted to it. There was no, the girls came to me one time and said, hey, everybody's got to have electric typewriter. By golly, everybody got electric typewriters. And I think we were really pretty progressive that way. And when we got the first IBM machine, of course, from then on we were IBM oriented, and we started computerizing pretty early mm-hmm. in the plant.
Mm-hmm. You got your first employee in 1950. You're a million sales in 1957.
66.
Yeah, November 11th.
Yes. That's how many employees would you have had at that time when you got to that million sales, roughly? What?
About 40.
But yeah, perhaps.
Would you say about 40 at that when we had a
perhaps
meeting?
So. I somewhat in group. Maybe even a little higher, 50, 60.
50? Mm-hmm. All right, something mm-hmm. like that.
Bruce, as you're into your teenage, are you doing things around the plant or what?
I did. That was, in fact, that was somewhat mandated. It seemed to be mandated for me. I'm not sure it was for any. But I was about 10, 11, 12.
Well, when you made powder pillows.
But I also even did some standard sample packaging.
Okay.
I also did
the
pH meter. So yeah, I in the summertime. In the summer, I was a summer employee, well below age 16, put it that way. And shipping department for a number of years.
But this wasn't true with the other children, or?
Well.
Mary didn't.
And then my brother Paul, 6 years younger, and so he. It was a little different time.
Sent Paul away to private school.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a different time in which, if you I think in the 1950s and 60s, self-employed people often brought their kids in at a very young age, mm-hmm. and I've read a couple of books and I've noticed, gosh, it happened a lot back then. And I did a lot of the manual work was really not very complicated. A lot of the work was essentially unskilled. And a lot of the chemical bottling was manual. Mm-hmm. Just had those great big vats, and you make up reagents, and they just have a little stopcock, and we fill up 4 ounce bottles. So you just sit there all day, and so there was a lot of.
That's been automated now.
A lot of manual work at that particular time, so anybody could do it.
And you went off to college?
Went off to college and went into the majored in liberal arts. It was a history major. Mm-hmm. And
you weren't told to go to chemistry?
Well, I tell you, I wasn't a very good student, and I kind of regret a little. And I think Clifford was so absorbed. That was, I tell you, teaching and mentoring was not his strength. That was kind of
life really wasn't his strength either.
I look back and say that was kind of a lost opportunity, because obviously I am interested, but I was young and immature, and I wasn't getting much instruction, and I really honestly wasn't terribly even completely interested. A lot of kids, your young teens, don't necessarily want to do what your parents are doing. But I wish I'd had a little bit more instruction at the time, because at this point, when I got started working at the company, ultimately I graduated, and...
Where did you go to undergrad?
Drake University.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I think we had, and I graduated in 1970, and I think we had 75 or 100 employees, something like that, at that time, and Kitty offered me a job in human resources. And I did serve that role fairly well as kind of a little bit of a liaison between the employees and the purpose of the company. And that seemed to be a kind of a comfortable fit.
Oh, it was. And Bruce made a real contribution there, because up until this point, the mission of the company and those kinds of thoughts, you know, we didn't have any, obviously, we didn't have any formal business background. You didn't think about business plans. Man, we were just charging ahead. It was just each day and try and make a little bit of profit and salt it away and don't touch it until we got enough accumulated to build the next room. You know, it's you almost should apologize that you didn't think, but but you didn't have the time. And then when Bruce came, of course, he had a different background, and he brought a lot of this thing. Hey, where are we going? What is our mission? What are we thinking about down the road? And it was very helpful and needed.
That's what I did.
And the employees liked him, Bruce, and so we never had union troubles, anything like that. Nobody would want to be unionized there. It was too good of a deal. I'm now going to inject something else. When, I'm almost 8 years ago when I married Don Darrow. Don came, threw his plane down, came to see me, and he said, this place is a country club. He said, you should see what it's like at American Airlines. You know, the ice cream was free, you know, the coffee was free, the donuts were free after 10 o'clock. You couldn't have more than a dollar and a half on a hot meal at the cafeteria.
So, taking us back into the 60s, it's growing. You're basically self-financing in the sense that not borrowing money.
No.
You're incorporated, but you're not, you know, a public company in any way. You're not selling shares. Tell us about this banker, Arthur Lucht.
Well,
what was his role with the company? What were you doing with banks?
He was, when we lived out on that Ashmore Street, he was our neighbor. And of course, and that was the bank that we did bank at. We had the bad flood, and now we're down on South Duff, and the university is out northwest of us, and the town is directly north of us, and then out toward the northeast of us is kind of a hill area that had been undeveloped out there. Later on, there was the National Animal Disease Lab was built out in that area, and we decided, okay, we've got enough, we ought to buy a piece of land and start thinking. Now Bruce has us thinking more about what future. We better buy some land for another addition, because we are down here in this floodplain, and by this time the city said no more building down there, Hawk. So all right, we bought 10 acres out on Dayton Avenue, and then we hired an architect and started what was called then Building 3. Isn't that right, Bruce? It was called Building 3 initially.
Yeah.
And it was going to be for instrument manufacturing, Arthur. Because we realized that we're really running out of space down on Old Duff Avenue and down in the floodplain. So we built that, or we bought that land and got the design for the building. Well, boy, now we don't have money, or this kind of money. Now this is big money now, you know, and you're not building one room, and we don't have the money.
what year is this?
This would be 1967.
Yeah,
67. And so we decided that we needed to borrow some money. And, you know, and Art Lucht was advising us on things. And, you know, he knew that we were going to go to Des Moines to see if we could borrow enough money for the building. And, you know, that rascal went down and contacted the bankers down there and said that if Cliff and Kitty Hawk come down here to borrow money, don't loan it to them. And boy, we got, well, of course, we didn't know this. So we went to one bank. Anymore, I can't tell you. I think it was Bankers.
Bankers Trust?
Bankers Trust, I think, was the one. It was Valley that finally loaned it to us. Bankers Trust, I think. And it was real strange. Here we laid out all of our financials and no debt, and we were profitable, and we were clean as a whistle. And here's this guy said, well, money's pretty tight, and no. And, golly, this didn't sound right to us, you know. So we came home, and then somebody said, well, you know, a pretty progressive bank is the Valley Trust. And so we packed up and went back to the Valley Trust. And by golly, the guy said, well, you know, your friend Arthur Lucht told us not to loan you any money. But he said, you know, I've looked at this, and he said, you know, you need it. And it seems to me it was like about $600,000 that we borrowed but we had the land was clear, and we had the foundation in, and you had to do that, you know, in those days you had to have that clear before you could borrow money. So we had the foundation in, and then we borrowed the money, and I think it was about like $600,000. Well, then along came 1968, and we were exhibiting in Chicago, I think at the ISA show. I talked with Bruce this morning about that, and that's the Instrument Society of America show.
Mm-hmm.
And along comes a guy by the name of Barney Cunningham from Blunt Ellis and Simmons, and that was at a time when IPOs were popular, and the joke was anybody who's anybody is going public. And Barney Cunningham talked us into it and said we could raise a bunch of money for you guys. Oh, oh, thank you, sweetheart.
That's fine.
Thank you, dear.
I'm just rubbing it off.
Thank you. Okay. So we went public in 1968. And paid off that loan.
What was Arthur Lucht's fear? Why was he trying to stop you from lending you money?
The only thing I don't know, Arthur. The only thing I would say was that he was just so conservative, you know. He took the attitude, you're doing just fine. Why? And you're making money. Why do this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, he didn't. He didn't realize. You know, we were just grinding away here.
Yes.
And that's the only thing I could say.
Going back again. One thing we haven't talked about is how you priced these things in the marketplace that you were doing. In most of the areas you didn't have competition. How did you know what the market would bear?
Well, we had pretty good cost analysis. And I'm embarrassed to tell you this. A pretty good accurate cost times five. It was pretty simple, but it worked, and it wasn't really excessive, and yet it was very profitable.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a times five factor of basic costs.
But which wasn't really your complete cost.
As I know it today, I would say no. But at that time, we thought it was. Because, you figured out the chemicals, and you figured out the bottle price, and you figured out the labor costs. EBITDA was not something that I knew about in those days. You know? So amortization depreciation, no.
Yes. Because, I mean, that if you say it that way around, it sounds as if you should have been able to finance the world from internal retained earnings.
Yeah, I think one of the real failures out of this whole thing, in my mind, is the whole state of Iowa. This is a state that is, but you know, it was a little bit of a different time, and I always got a little bit of a quirky personality, less so today. Boy, back in the 1950s and 60s, a popular political movement in Iowa was called land use, and thinking that this is the most fertile, which it is, farmland in the world, and they wanted to kind of minimize any type of development that would take farmland out of production. And that had a very strong central theme kind of written into a little bit the Iowa culture. But I was going to say, the state of Iowa should have been desperate to develop a company that is actually going to employ its chemists, because the chemists graduated from the local universities with no jobs. So the state of Iowa kind of failed in that respect.
That's right.
To not really rally its financial institutions to make sure that this company gets whatever it wants and stays here. Mm-hmm. And so, but, you know, they would never do that today.
No.
I really don't think they would. But
back then,
there was kind of a little bit of an anti-industrial movement thinking mm-hmm. our rich black loam should not be covered by a tractor factory.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, if you, it's very interesting, just you're doing this startup in the era in time that Silicon Valley is starting up with chemists
yeah.
very central to that startup, and Stanford University loving them to death.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge contrast.
Oh, there wasn't any loving.
A huge contrast.
Yeah. Well, there really is. As a matter of fact, we were there, that maybe just only happened in the Midwest, but there were towns like Ames that just did not have a very strong support for industry, and there wasn't much.
Cliff and I went to a Chamber of Commerce meeting in Ames, Iowa one time, and Keith Rushing was the president, Bruce, and I remember that Keith got up and made a speech. And he said, while here in Ames, we like all the industry we have, we don't want any more brown bags. And I wanted to, of course, I'm a walker out. When I don't like something like that, I get up and walk out. I was so angry at that Chamber of Commerce that say a thing like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they never say it today, but that,
Oh no!
That was a point in time,
and we refused to join the Chamber of Commerce.
So in 68,
we get in time.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
In 68, there's a conversation then about going public. What was Bruce's reaction?
Bruce?
I'm sorry, Clifford. I'm sorry.
Oh. I think he saw it as a way out of this debt, and we had a lawyer, Bob Case, by this time, and Bob was getting to the place that he was saying, look, you've got estate matters, if you really need to. He said you have never taken any money out of the company, which we hadn't, and our salaries were very modest, and because everything was just poured back in,
mm-hmm.
and I think Bob Case really he said, if I were you, I'd go public and then I'd run. Well, what he meant to do, of course, he wanted acquisitions, and you know, which were things that, well,
right.
we weren't very good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Up before 68, there hadn't been any concept of stock options or something equivalent to employees. I mean, it was a salaried occupation. Yeah.
You know what was really a very motivating factor for, you're right, there was no, was essentially deferred gratification. There was no stock options and it was egalitarian, but the company seemed to have a sense of direction, and that created a certain incentive to motivating incentive that won't last forever, but it was pretty effective in the 50s and 60s, and people were happy to be on board,
part of something,
and saw themselves as having a better potential promotional opportunity because the company was growing. So there was very little pressure, I think, on material stock options and so forth. But the future looked good, and that was inherently...
Well, I think, yeah, I think you and used was, the right word. The company was growing so fast that actually there were times, you know, it was passing people.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that there weren't opportunities.
Yes.
It was growing.
And the islands are
people.
The islands are kind of agrarian. It's essentially an insecure group. So we provide. So work was a sense of community.
Yes.
This wasn't a bunch of.
Yes, the harvest was guaranteed.
Yeah.
Yes. What going public? I mean, that's in fact a huge transition step. I mean, talk about how it worked. What difference it made.
All of a sudden, you're in a glass house,
yeah.
and all of a sudden, you have quarterly reports.
Yes.
And if we thought we were getting sophisticated before, man, it was after that we really started.
Yes. Well, you had to at that moment specify. I mean, who was the chair of the board? Who was the CEO? Who was the board?
All right. The board was this Barney Cunningham was one of the men, and the other one was our patent attorney Fred Leidig, and then Bob Case, the attorney, and Art Lucht, the banker, and Cliff and me. That was it. Okay. And Barney Cunningham only wanted to sell us off. And he just kept trying to put us together. And so we asked him, or we just told him, that he was not standing for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that this was some of the times when you're beginning to... Boy, I tell you, you're growing up pretty fast now, you know. When you have to say, you do not get to stand for re-election on this board.
Okay.
And but Barney just had one, he just had dollar signs in his eyes, and we just had to get rid of him.
Yeah. You know, I don't have absolutely any quantification for this, but I sense a little bit that there was the investment community embraced a public offering of a small company back then. Today they wouldn't at all. But today, if you're not $1 billion, you should never even be never be public. But back then, it seemed like there was a lot of encouragement of that sort of thing. But there's no question we were too small to go public.
Oh, and, we were 1,680,000 in sales.
I was a college student at the time, but I do sense a little bit. You know, Iowa had a lot of public offerings that did real well, but they were small companies.
Yeah.
And that was it was almost like a different era.
We came
on the tail end of a different era.
At $13 a share, and came and closed at $21 that night.
Mm-hmm. Which exchange was this on?
NASDAQ.
Yes. And what fraction of the, how many
the
shares were there, and how many were?
Oh, I think it was about 25%. I'm sorry, I can't remember just exactly how many. I have all of that, but I don't...
Well, what was your percentage, you and Cliff's percentage? Was it over 60? You certainly had over 50.
Oh, yes. I think it was about more like 75.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you actually owned.
Yeah, and of course Cliff had the big percentage of it, and I had a lesser.
And he was president, and you were vice president still?
Yes, and then he took a title of chairman of the board. But then down here, I became chairman of the board really rather early, because Cliff said, look, you prepare everything, you get it all ready, and he said, this is not me. And he said, I don't even want it. And so that's just Cliff.
Do we have the date right there? When did you become?
Well, it says 87. And that may have been about right. Formally.
Yes, but informally.
The election. But informally I had been. I did all the contact with the board and made up the agenda. But of course, by this time, there were there was a good CFO who had reports to make, and we had.
But the company, though, was, as I say, that contributed this, an extraordinarily, boy, talk about today's accounting, extraordinarily honest accounting. Yeah. Gosh, we paid bills in 7 days. Yeah, all and the balance sheets, and it was really fairly profitable. This chemistry stuff was about 80% at a high gross margin. So the company was pretty profitable. So there was nothing to hide. Yeah. And so that did help a little bit. It was the books were about as clean, as honest as accounting right. books could ever be.
Yeah.
And that was helpful.
Yeah.
If we, again, looking back on the 20, 21 years before going public, am I correct in thinking that the CEO was, it was really a co-CEO or some strange combination of the two of you who was
you
CEO?
Oh, yeah. Clifford was had an inherent, innate, intuitive sense of chemistry and actually the reconfiguration of a chemical formula. I've even heard some people say it was almost psychic in a way what he could do. But he was not a manager of systems, and he was not really a business manager.
He wasn't a manager of people.
That was not his forte. But on the other hand, he also visualized all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so he had his talent, but running the company and managing systems wasn't one of them. Mm-hmm. And we alluded to that last night, rather, when we said he could actually make up a reagent in his laboratory that was so incredibly creative. But transferring that to mass production and understanding the processes in between was a little vague. But it's the old story, we all have our strengths, and but running the company wasn't one of them.
So Kitty, did you then actually get involved in some of the translation to mass production, or was it more still with the sort of sales and marketing?
I was sales and marketing. Right. I was really kind of front office by this time. No, there were others that were I watched what was going on, and I was very much aware of it, but the real scaling up was done by others.
Now everyone of course knew that you had the inside track to Clifford. Would employees who had sort of some ideas that they thought might be good come to you if they were having problems, if they argued with him, would they come to you and say, can you give me some advice, can you help me out?
I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Within
reason.
Yeah.
I would say one thing, though, there was never, our problem was, was never a lack of good ideas. I think the problem was so many of the ideas just had limited market. So we had almost more products. There were a lot more products than there were high growth markets or high volume markets. But I would say basically it was pretty open, and people did. However, Cliff certainly had certain boundaries, and if they were in direct conflict with Cliff, I think they knew when that it wasn't going to do any good to come to Kitty. On the whole, things were it was a pretty harmonious firm.
I would say so.
But he was really as things began to grow, he was more and more in what we might say in R&D. I mean,
Absolutely.
I mean, over time, you might say he became the R&D manager. Is that a way of?
I say he was R&D from the very beginning.
Yes.
Always R&D.
Yeah, but I mean, he kind of, if you will, his role.
Yeah.
It's a strange word to use, but his role contracted into R&D.
That's right. You know,
statement?
In the early days, in the 50s, we talked about the 50s so much, but then they were important. This is one thing that was a unique distinction in the late 40s and 50s. He really put in his time at the drinking water plant and the waste treatment plant, physically visiting the sites and finding out exactly what they needed, and that was considered, classic they call it applications marketing. So then you take all these parameters we have, and they could be reconfigured, or their range is stretched, or they're to meet exactly what they needed. And he was good at that. He was really good at that. And he even used to have an old expression: if you're going to be in a town longer than 2 hours, you have enough time to go to the drinking water plant. And he was always welcomed there because there was hardly anybody else going to the drinking water plant.
Yeah.
So it became a...
Oh, yeah.
But I would say in the 80s and 90s, he didn't have that. That was almost a magic touch to be able to figure out exactly what they needed and simplify their procedures. But I don't think he had that same touch in the 90s, especially some attempts at some of these same tests in agricultural and soil and food production wasn't as successful.